May it please the court. My name is Gina Shecker from the law firm of Casimir Pearson Shecker. I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiffs below, the appellants before this court, which in this case are my company, Happy Tales Development, LLC, and myself. I respectfully submit this case concerns whether an appointed member of a commission, which is without any legislative authority and who is not engaged in any lawmaking activity, can publish false and defamatory statements about a business owner and her business through email messages from the member's private email account and intentionally interfere with a real estate contract to promote the member's own self-interest, yet be absolutely shielded from any possibility of legal recourse from the commission member's intentional misconduct. We submit that this court has not rendered such an opinion and that the circuit court's determination of such in favor of appellee, Ms. Bufalt in this case, is erroneous, reversible error, worthy of this court's consideration, reversal, and remand. The facts are that while my company and I were seeking a special use permit, Ms. Bufalt sent email messages from her personal email account to third parties which contained false, defamatory statements about me, my business, and members of my family associated with the project that we sought to develop in Clark County. The defamatory statements complained of in the pleading were outside of any public hearing or public meeting, but were made through private email communications. The defamatory statements complained of did not concern the relevant criteria necessary to determine whether a special use permit should be granted.
Counsel, may I ask you a question? I believe in your briefs you had some concern over the concept of sting, that in order to be defamatory, words had to have a certain sting to them. What do you believe the Virginia standard is as far as that goes?
I believe we have asserted the Carwile case that talks about what the necessary requirements are.
Mm-hmm.
If I could look at that for your honor. I think that case is instructive because it does recognize that it's the varying circumstances, the context in which a statement is made that will give it the defamatory effect. In Carwile, the court acknowledges that although varying circumstances make it difficult to determine whether particular language is defamatory, it's a general rule that allegedly defamatory words are to be taken in their plain and natural meaning and understood by courts. In determining whether the words and statements complained of in the instant case are reasonably capable of the meaning ascribed to them by innuendo, every fair inference that may be drawn from the pleading must be resolved in the plaintiff's favor.
Okay, I guess my question, maybe I'm not making it clear enough. The second restatement of torts uses language such as it's defamatory that tends to harm the reputation of another, so it's to lower him or her in the estimation of the community. In a Fourth Circuit case, we said defamatory words are those which make the plaintiff appear odious, infamous, or ridiculous. Our model jury instruction says that in normal usage, they're understood to harm the person's reputation. What's our standard?
I would say that there's been different articulations of it, but that the words have to be understood in their plain meaning to harm the person's reputation.
Okay.
In its plainest context or manner in understanding the words. So
how do these words that you've alleged, how do they harm your reputation and that of your company?
The statements are made that saying that I am a liar.
Okay, I got that one. Okay, I understand that one.
I am less than truthful and can't be trusted.
Okay, that's two of them, but you've got about five or six others that
yes, you're
right. Less
correct. The other statements concern allegations by the defendant in this case that our proposed project is going to violate a private easement agreement. It's going to violate private restrictive covenants.
How does that hurt your reputation?
It's essentially calling us lawbreakers. We're not referring to a statute, but Ms. Bufalt is saying is that if you do what you're saying you're going to do, you're violating a conservation easement. Therefore, you're going to impact the environment. What it tells those that are considering our application, which includes the entire community because this process subjects you to a public hearing, is that this developer, this business owner, doesn't care about the environment. It doesn't care about our community.
But why would that not be constitutionally protected opinion? I mean, we've had in the last several months conservation easement cases. No one really knows what the answer is going to be until the court rules.
In this case, I think it's very clear, Your Honor. You ask a good question. In order to maintain the application in the first place, the applicant was required to get the approval of the easement holder in this case. And that fact was further memorialized in the letter that the sellers were then subsequently requested to obtain as a result of Ms. Lufall's statement. So it was very clear in this case that there was approval of the
My point is, isn't it a matter of opinion as to whether someone interprets a conservation easement one way or another way? And the ultimate question of whether or not there's an actual violation almost always depends upon a court ruling. And even then, if the court ruling is disputed among the judges, it's hard to say that there's ever a statement of fact preceding it for which you could be liable for defamation.
Well, we're not in a court proceeding in this case, which I think is relevant to the, because there is no other indicia of reliability with respect to a statement being tested. If you make an allegation and a complaint that this is unlawful, then you have then that would be protected, as Your Honor would say, and it recognizes, and then you'd have an opportunity to prove. That's not what we have here. What we have here is documentary evidence attached to an application, part of the public record, saying this easement holder has approved. It is not, in their mind, a violation.
But then the speaker may still disagree with that, and the speaker's opinion is, well, it doesn't matter what the staff has written up. They think that she thinks that the easement was violated. Isn't that just a matter of opinion?
I would submit not, because that fact can be proven. That can be proven true or false, ultimately.
Well, you can have all sorts of opinions that are false.
Yes, and I would argue that they would be, if it can be proven true or false, that statement is actionable. Just as if there was an alleged violation of a statute here, I think is a clearer case, even though Ms. Lufant might have said, I think Ms. Shecker is violating this statute. If it can be proven true or false, I would argue that because we're outside of legal proceedings, she's making these allegations in some other forum that doesn't have an opportunity where to respond or the indicia of reliability that a court case would have, that is an actionable statement. That just couching your statement in my opinion is not sufficient in order to avoid liability in this case.
I struggle to see how some of these comments are damaging to your reputation. I see that they may interfere with your attempting to acquire the special use permit that you're attempting to attempt, but I just don't see how they damage your reputation, but you've got a lot of things to talk about, not much time, so go ahead.
If I may, just briefly, Your Honor, because I think that is the initial ruling that the circuit court made in this case, is that none of the statements were actionable, therefore we should have been dismissed on that basis. I would submit that the court went a step further in this case and addressed an affirmative defense that there wasn't any support for, but the preliminary inquiry by the trial court was, are these statements actionable? In Virginia, the court serves, or the judge gets to serve as a bit of a gatekeeper in this regard. However, based on the pleading, and that this is a demur, we should be afforded every opportunity and every inference.
Well, isn't this the place where the judge does the gatekeeping and then demur stage?
I would agree, but the standard should be that every inference should be decided in the plaintiff's favor in this case. How these statements, if I may address your question.
Let me ask you to move on, because I'd like to hear what you say about legislative immunity. I also want to hear what you say about the intentional the interference with the contractual.
Absolutely.
You don't have that much time, so.
Very well.
Go for it.
Very well. With respect to legislative immunity, if I could move on, we maintain that these statements are actionable, that they do injure my reputation as a business person, not just as an attorney who has clients and have been called a liar and somebody who's not truthful, but also because I am a business owner and I'm proposing to develop a project within this community which needs public approval in order to be accepted. Why legislative immunity does not apply in this case is this is not part of the special permit process. This is directly something to the contrary. This is an end run around the process. Just because she is a appointed commission member doesn't give her the right, without any repercussion, to make defamatory statements. Just because we're being considered for a special use permit. This wasn't a situation where there was a meeting or that information was being conveyed. Matter of fact, there would be problems. I would submit that if counsel was going to argue to this to the justices that this was somehow a public meeting through email exchanges about this particular
Most of the communications were with the Planning Commission director and other members of the Planning Commission and zoning administrator and others, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
People who would be interested in this special use permit, wouldn't they?
As would neighbors and a lot of other people that would be interested. But this isn't with respect to the relevant criteria. For instance, this isn't a communication that says this is a violation of an archaeological site. Or it's
where do you draw the line for legislative immunity? Where do you think it extends to? I guess you understand there is. We do believe there's a legislative immunity.
I would submit it does not apply here because the person of consideration is not a member of a legislative body. This is not a body that is elected.
Okay, how about qualified immunity? Does that apply here?
First of all, I would submit that the court never reached that decision, but I would say absolutely no. There are no facts to show that these people had a reason to know or had to know. This is communications that's completely unrelated to the relevant criteria that the commission would have been considering
but
at the time.
But qualified privilege doesn't have that nexus requirement that says that if you're in this interest group, that you got to limit yourself to relevant criteria to the interest group. You can go well outside. As long as you're in that interest group and you're talking about a subject, you can be incredibly outside the scope of the subject and still get the benefit. Now, that doesn't mean much because you've pled actual malice, and that would be an exception to qualified privilege anyway.
You're right, Your Honor. And why I think it's confusing in this case is we have never reached that. In order to assert that, that is an affirmative defense, and we are here on a demur. This was not a plea and bar where evidence was adduced before the court and accepted so that we would have findings of fact made by the court. We were being forced at once legislative immunity
was
into
answer.
It, we would say that was an inappropriate ruling on behalf of
Do you want to talk about your tortious interference? Because, again, you're down to your last few minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. We submit that Virginia law and this court's cases would support our claim for tortious interference here.
Have we ever extended that tort to a situation where the contract is still in effect? You still have a contract.
No, Your Honor. I do want to make that clarification. The contract was terminated. It was pled in the complaint that it was terminated. So it was terminated. I think Ms. Judkins had been making the argument that because I terminated the contract, because I could no longer afford to carry the land while we continued with the process.
Okay.
But the contract was terminated.
And we're abused in a situation where the plaintiff terminated the contract.
That is correct. And that's why we've pled the Duggins case. We've asserted the Duggins case, where in that case, the plaintiff also assigned the contract rights. And in Duggan, the plaintiff was complaining that the interference occurred to the plaintiff. This court has not made the distinction whether the wrong had to apply to the plaintiff that brought the case or to some third party. It's the tortious interference that is the conduct being complained of, whether it occurs to the plaintiff in the case or to a third party.
But it still has to be intentional, and it has to be some intent to interfere with a foreseeable contractual relationship in a reasonably foreseeable way.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in this case, it's very clear, because it's part of the application, that there is a land sale that is pending. The sellers are involved. They have to sign the application. And, for instance, a point that we brought up earlier, because of the statements, the defamatory statements that we've alleged in this case, with respect to the conservation easements, we had to continue to get the sellers involved in this case. They had to go back. They had to get additional approvals. We needed their cooperation, their continued participation in hearings, in
petitions. And you said it cost you more money.
It did, because we were forced to address these defamatory statements. We had to hire scientists.
Well, that seems logical, but have we ever gone that far to say that is an element of that can be a basis for?
I would say that it's very clear in the restatement, Section 766A, and I would say that this court has not made the distinction. It has expressly adopted 766, but increasing the cost of performance, I would submit, is consistent with the Duggan opinion in this that this court has rendered.
Given your point of view, would anyone who opposed a special use permit be guilty of tortious interference with the contract to buy the property?
No, Your Honor. Because there are certain activities that have to equate to intentional interference, not just any opposition, right? In this case, we have alleged defamatory statements.
But they weren't made to the person who was selling you the property, though.
As well as harassment and getting third parties to interfere with people that were supporting the project. It was visible to myself, I was aware of it, as well as the sellers, which gave them reservations about our ability to settle on the property.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Julia Judkins here for the appellee, Robina Buffo. I'm going to argue to you that the trial court made the right decision, perhaps not for all the right reasons. The legislative immunity. Neither I nor Ms. Shecker nor the judge were aware of the case and had no excusable reason on the Sinclair Wireless case. Put that aside on legislative immunity. My argument to you is these statements are not defamatory. They're not actionable. And the standard is more than just a damage to reputation. If you look at the case of Moss versus Harwood, the court said, if the words employed in a libel tend to injure the defendant and it is in his good name, fame, and credit, and to bring him into public scandal, infamy, and disgrace, they are actionable, although not imputing an indictable defense. So we have here 9 statements.
Well, calling someone a liar, generally speaking, to an average citizen would be perceived as a bit of a slight.
But the Eighth Circuit has said, and that's a federal court interpreting federal law, which the First Amendment is, in Lauterbach, calling someone a liar is not actionable.
But that was before the Bose cases and all the other cases from the Supreme Court refining the opinion concept under First Amendment law.
Yes, and even the case relied on by Ms. Shecker, the appellant in this case, makes a distinction between someone saying something either under oath, before a court. In fact, that United States Supreme Court case she cited, they were testifying under oath versus the context in which my client has laid out certain facts which are not disputed. For example, the one email where Ms. Buffo says, it would appear that Ms. Shecker is being less than truthful. That's one, that one could infer she's calling her a liar. In the context of that statement, which is Exhibit C to the amended complaint, she goes through an entire factual recitation, which is not contested here. It's not attacked that during a question and answer period involved in the Planning Commission's debate over the special use application that Ms. Shecker talked about a 40-dog kennel. She indicated they did not have a commercial kennel, only their own dogs. And then Ms. Buffo says, I went to the website. This is what happened in Loudoun County. She has a website where she's advertising that they do have a professional kennel. It would appear that Ms. Shecker was not totally truthful. That does not render her infamous, does not render her... It's not even actually calling her a liar.
But that statement is not the same statement as the liar statement.
Well, that's the first of what I would classify as...
Okay, whether someone may appear, may look like, but if you flat out say they are a liar, isn't that different in kind and in degree?
Your Honor, no. I say that if I say you are a liar, you are a liar, that... The Eighth Circuit has said is an opinion, is constitutionally protected
speech.
Let's
assume for the sake of argument that we'll have to look beyond the Eighth Circuit to answer this question. How would you argue to us based upon our case law that statement alone, someone is lying, they are a liar, is protected First Amendment opinion speech?
Well, in the Mosley versus Moss case, the court said many, many years ago.
That was a long time ago.
Yes, it was.
I think times may have changed since 1850, though.
It was a long time ago. But the reasons the court reached that opinion and conclusion have not changed. Because...
Well, one thing, we don't have dueling anymore. That's what would happen in that case.
Right? When somebody made a statement like that, there was a duel that usually occurred. We try not to have those anymore.
Well, we don't, no. But we do a lot of other things. For example, other things going on. Anybody on any given day can say, you are a liar. That's a lie. You're a liar.
The dilemma in this case is a little bit more than that. I mean, the plaintiff in this case is representing herself, and she's representing a business, and that makes, she's a lawyer. And your position is this is a tribunal of some sort. And what it is, it's an allegation that a member of the Virginia State Bar has made a false statement to a tribunal. Now, the next step after that, if it's true, if that statement is true, is a trip to the disciplinary system of the Virginia State Bar. So this is not just an ordinary quarrel between two neighbors about, well, you said that your apples fell on my property. No, it's not true. You're a liar. This is something that actually affects a person's professional licensing and their reputation. Why isn't it different?
Well, because extrapolating from that, if she had a lawyer representing herself and the company, and the lawyer offered her as a witness to say things, she would not have any entitlement to the fact that she was a person with a kennel.
So you think that a member of the state bar can insulate themselves from disciplinary action by becoming a witness and lying as opposed to being a lawyer and lying?
No, I don't. But I don't think just because someone is a lawyer going through a special use application process that really has nothing to do with their practice gets greater protection than someone else who came in and said...
But you take your plaintiffs as they come. I mean, we all remember Ms. Falsgraf, right?
Yes.
All right, this plaintiff happens to be a lawyer for which integrity and trustworthiness is extremely important, and you take your plaintiff as they come.
We do, but if you look at the context in these statements, my client has not said Gina Schecker is a liar. That's a characterization of what she said. My client has said, based on all of these things that are set forth herein, I believe she's being less than truthful. I believe that she's lying and manipulating the facts.
That was a milder one. Let's go to the more serious one.
The most serious one, I would say...
Wouldn't the most serious one be the October 4th?
As Judge Wetzel wrestled with on the record, definitely.
Yep.
That's the October 4th where there is a dispute, there's a debate going on between my client, the zoning director, and the chairman of the planning commission. All right, those are three people. She got these through FOIA, which is obviously a public record. And my client is setting forth, this is what you said, Jesse, the zoning director, about the nature of this project. This is what she said that she does not intend to do. Here, saying that someone else called someone else a liar, you have two statements here. Two. I firmly believe that Gina is lying and manipulating the facts. That's one thing. But she's also suing over the statement, Jesse, she's calling you a liar. So that's, for example, myself saying, so-and-so lied, called you a liar. So-and-so called you a liar. How is that defamatory? That's number one. Number two, lying and I firmly believe that she's lying and manipulating facts based on the context of our application doesn't have enough information about what this project is or is not about, and you all are talking about things in the hallway. Don't do that anymore. And trust no one? That's not saying she's not trustworthy. That's making a giant leap of inference. And you cannot ignore the context in which these statements are being made.
But lying is so different from making a mistake. I mean, every application to a planning commission may have a material mistake of some fact, whether relevant or irrelevant, but pointing that out is not defamatory. I see this question. I see some contrary information in the file, however. That's very different from saying, you know what, she's just a liar.
Well, I argue to you that saying, I firmly believe that Gina is lying is different than saying, she is a liar. She is a liar.
That can insulate anything, wouldn't it? Oh, you can say, I think. You can say anything you want to about somebody. Is that the way our law works?
Well, under those circumstances, I couldn't say to my neighbor, I think so-and-so is a liar about whatever, anything. The reason
Well, you probably couldn't if it was factually incorrect and you published it and it defamed the person's reputation. That's what the law of defamation is all about.
But case law does not support that calling someone a liar is defamatory. That's constitutional. It has to be more than that. It has to be lying in the context of under oath. It has to be accusing them of perjury. It has to be accusing them of something more than just lying about whether or not she intends to live there, whether or not it's a kennel that they're going to board more than 40 dogs, whether or not she's ever had a kennel before. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about she is a lawyer who lied in court about a particular fact that in and of itself is actionable. What my client is saying here is she's manipulating the facts about whether this is going to be an enterprise where there's a dwelling unit, for example. That's one of the facts. This is an enterprise where there's going to be 40 dogs, less than 40 dogs. I have never had a kennel before. I have never advertised about a kennel before. So my client is saying that appears less than truthful. So how does that make her odious or infamous to say that she has never had a kennel before, and my client to say, look at this website, which is not contested. They don't dispute she had the website. That's my client's opinion.
You say to somebody in response to what you've just raised, that's not true. That is a focus upon the subject matter. It's either accurate or it's not. If you focus on somebody and say, she's a liar, you are now focusing upon the reputation of the person. And there's the difference. You can talk all you want about, she wants a 40-dog kennel. Well, I don't think that's accurate. Okay, fine. This kennel's 60. But when you cross the line and you say something that has to do with character and reputation, she is a liar. That's where the problem is.
She is a liar in the context of she's not going to live there, she is going to live there, she's never advertised before as a kennel, but she has advertised before as a kennel. She is a liar in general. I argue to you that is beyond what the federal courts have recognized.
Well, you of course know that we're not bound by the Eighth Circuit. We might have great respect for all the judges in the nation. We're not even bound by the Fourth Circuit, and we really like them. All right? We're bound by the United States Supreme Court, our precedents, and our understanding of common law principles.
I understand. There's a lot of other statements, obviously, in here that the judge also correctly. I do want to address the tortious interference.
Please.
She did not plead that the contract was either breached or terminated. Go back and look at the actual amended complaint, count 3, that was never pleaded. What was pleaded is, it might have been. It almost was. I had to pay extra money to keep it from being terminated, not that it was terminated. And there's never been a case in the Virginia Supreme Court, in this circuit, for that matter, where that's enough to say tortious interference or contract. And this is not the Duggins case. My client had no interest in that property except she didn't want a kennel. She didn't care if Ms. Shecker bought the property. She just didn't want the kennel on the property. And as a member of the Planning Commission, she had every right to do so. And qualified privilege should apply, regardless of whether or not you believe it as a matter of law, because it's on the record that all of these communications were between members of the Planning Commission.
But that would be an affirmative defense.
I understand. But it also limits what can happen. But tortious interference... No, and the contract she attached. The contract, Exhibit J, says entered into March 14, 2014, which is well after all of these email communications, and it's in effect. It's still in effect. It's never been terminated. It's never been breached. In that contract, she says we are renegotiating terms, but this is not a tortious interference claim. This is a member of the Planning Commission questioning why you should or should not get the special use application, which has nothing to do with whether she buys the property or not. Whatever terms they negotiated between themselves as to why she wants to buy the property.
Justin, let's be fair, though. She's also saying that you're also a member of the, you're a member of the Planning Commission, but you also personally don't want this because it's too close to your property.
Yes.
And you have malice, and that's what you're doing. So that would get involved in the tortious interference, wouldn't it? But my question is isn't it logical to say that if you cause a contract to be more expensive, that would also be a tortious interference? I know we've never gone there, but is that a logical extension?
No, sir, it is not a logical extension. Even the case she relies on, she relies on all these out-of-state cases. The Connecticut case wasn't even a tortious interference case. That was somebody dumping stuff on somebody's right that by contract they had the right to use the road. All that did, that was a trespass case. No, that's not a logical extension of tortious interference because it's always been said you'd have to change the elements. You'd have to undo precedent and say an element is now not just that it has to be terminated. It's that you had to make it more expensive for them. But look at the contract. Exhibit J. My time is up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Call the next case.